A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about the Mossad pager operation and those Israeli Forex scam investigations we've dug into, and he noticed something. Both stories hinge on companies that aren't quite what they seem, but they're not the same thing. One is a front company, BAC Consulting in Budapest, real office, real invoices, real employees, all serving a hidden intelligence mission. The other is a shell company, registered in Malta or Delaware, zero employees, no operations, existing purely to hold money or obscure who owns what. His question is, what's actually the difference? And does shell company always mean something shady, or are there legitimate reasons to set one up?
This is one of those distinctions where the conflation drives me up the wall. People use shell company and front company interchangeably in news coverage, on social media, even in some legal commentary, and they are fundamentally different beasts. A front company has a pulse. It hires people, pays taxes, signs contracts. Its cover is operational. A shell company is a legal container. It exists on paper, and that's the whole point.
The pager operation is almost the perfect case study because Back Consulting wasn't some hastily assembled fiction. It had a Budapest office, a website, supply chain relationships. It was doing real business, just not the business anyone thought it was doing.
And that's the operational test in a nutshell. If you walked into BAC Consulting's office, you'd see desks and computers and people answering phones. If you walked into a shell company's office, you'd find a registered agent's mailbox and nothing else. One is a mask over a mission. The other is a container for ownership or money. The mask costs millions to maintain. The container costs a few $100 a year in filing fees.
Which is why intelligence agencies use fronts and fraudsters, use shells, broadly speaking. The cost structures dictate the use case.
And this is where Daniel's question gets really interesting, because he's asking whether shell companies are inherently malicious. The short answer is no. The long answer is, it depends entirely on what you're doing with them. Every major tech company has a Delaware holding company. Every ETF you've ever invested in probably routes through a special purpose vehicle. These are shell-like structures. They're not crimes, they're plumbing.
The plumbing is also what made the Panama Papers possible. 11.5 million documents from Mossack Fonseca. Thousands of shell companies, some perfectly legal, some hiding oligarch money and sanctions evasion. The structure doesn't know what it's being used for.
That's the taxonomy problem Daniel's pointing at. We've loaded the term shell company with moral weight, but the entity itself is neutral. It's a tool. A hammer can build a house or break a window. The hammer doesn't care.
Let's actually define these terms because they get thrown around a lot, often interchangeably. But they mean very different things, and the difference isn't academic. It matters for investigators, for journalists, for anyone trying to understand what they're looking at when a company name shows up in a scandal.
A front company is a functional business whose primary mission is covert. It has employees, revenue, a physical presence, tax filings, client relationships. The business is real. The mission is hidden. Intelligence agencies use them for operations. Sanctioned entities use them to keep trading. Corporate espionage operations use them to infiltrate competitors. The key word is functional.
A shell company is a legal entity with minimal to no operations, assets, or employees. Its purpose is structural, holding intellectual property, managing tax liability, obscuring beneficial ownership. It's a vessel, not a going concern. Registered in a low-disclosure jurisdiction, maintained through annual fees and a registered agent, and that's about it.
The cost difference tells you everything. Running BAC Consulting probably costs millions. Real salaries, real rent, real supply chain logistics. A Delaware shell company costs a few $100s to register and a couple hundred a year to maintain. You can set one up in an afternoon.
Of course there are.
That's the gray zone Daniel's getting at. Some entities blur the line. A shell company that suddenly starts trading goods to launder money becomes a de facto front. A front company that stops its covert mission and just operates as a business becomes a legitimate company. The taxonomy is functional, not fixed.
Which is why the question, is this a shell company or a front company, sometimes has the wrong framing. The better question is, what is this entity actually doing right now?
With those definitions in hand, let's look under the hood at how each type actually operates. The mechanics tell you everything. Take BAC Consulting. The Mossad didn't just register a name in Budapest and call it a day. They built a company that could withstand scrutiny. Real office, real website, real contracts with suppliers. The pager components moved through legitimate supply chains. Customs officials looked at the paperwork and saw a normal electronics trading firm.
Because nothing was flaggable. That's the elegance of a well-run front. The cover story isn't a story. It's the actual business operations. The covert mission is compartmentalized. Most employees probably had no idea what they were really doing.
That's standard tradecraft. You hire genuine staff to do genuine work, and the sensitive layer sits with a handful of people. The invoices are real, the tax filings are real. If a regulator audits you, everything checks out. The only thing hidden is the ultimate purpose.
Contrast that with a Delaware LLC. You register it through a formation agent for a few $100. The address is the agent's office in Wilmington. There's a certificate of formation and an operating agreement, and that's it. No employees, no revenue, no physical footprint. It exists to hold something. A bank account, a piece of real estate, a patent portfolio.
Delaware has over 1 million of these, more registered entities than actual residents. The state has built an entire industry around being the jurisdiction of choice for corporate anonymity. Good legal infrastructure, specialized chancery courts, no requirement to disclose beneficial ownership publicly. It's not a loophole, it's the product they're selling.
Which is why people conflate the two. Both look opaque from the outside. Both obscure something. But the operational reality is night and day. One is a business with a secret. The other is a legal container that happens to have a name.
The conflation gets reinforced by how these things surface in the news. When a scandal breaks, the headline says, Shell Company used to launder millions. The reader pictures a fake office with fake employees. But what's actually being described is usually a paper entity. No office, no employees, just a registration number and a bank account in the Caymans.
The mental image does the rest. People assume a shell company is a Potemkin village, because that's what the word shell suggests. Something hollowed out, a facade. But it's not even that. It's just a legal form. The facade isn't there.
This is where the distinction starts to matter legally. If investigators raid a front company, they find evidence. Payroll records, emails, security footage, actual people to interview. If they raid a shell company, they find a filing cabinet in a lawyer's office in the Caymans. The investigative path is completely different.
Different paper trail, different crime. A front company is potentially evidence of a covert operation. Intelligence activity, sanctions evasion, corporate espionage. A shell company isn't evidence of anything by itself. It's what flows through it that determines whether you're looking at tax planning or money laundering.
The legal trade-offs are fascinating once you think about them. A front company is expensive and operationally risky. You're putting real people in real offices, generating real records. But it buys you legitimacy. Customs agents wave your shipments through. Banks open accounts for you. Suppliers extend credit. You're a known quantity.
The shell company buys you the opposite. It's cheap and low risk operationally. Nobody's going to blow cover because there's nobody to blow cover. But it buys you opacity, not legitimacy. Banks flag shell company accounts. Tax authorities scrutinize them. You can't build supplier relationships with a P.O. box in Wilmington.
Which is exactly why the multi-shell companies from those moving scam investigations worked the way they did. The fraudsters needed opacity, not legitimacy. They weren't trying to convince customs officials or business partners they were real. They just needed a legal entity that could receive payments and make tracing difficult. A shell in Malta does that for a few hundred euros a year.
The moment one of those shells got burned, they'd register another one. The cost of replacement is near zero. That's the structural advantage. You can't do that with a front. If back consulting gets exposed, you've lost millions in sunk costs and years of operational build-up.
The trade-off is basically, front companies buy you durability, shell companies buy you disposability. Different tools for different jobs.
Which brings us to Delaware. over a million entities registered there, and the reason isn't that Delaware is some kind of rogue jurisdiction. It's the opposite. Delaware has incredibly sophisticated corporate law, a specialized chancery court that moves fast, and a legal framework that's predictable. Companies go there because they want certainty, not because they want to hide.
The side effect is that beneficial ownership stays hidden. You can register a Delaware LLC, and the public record shows the registered agent's address and nothing about who actually owns it. That's not a bug in the system. For many legitimate uses, privacy is the point. Family offices don't want their net worth discoverable through a quick Google search. That's not inherently nefarious.
Though it does make the investigator's job harder. You're trying to trace ownership, and you hit a Delaware LLC, and suddenly the trail goes cold. The entity exists. You can see its filing history, but you have no idea who's behind it without a subpoena.
That's the operational reality that connects these two worlds. A front company says, "Look over here, we're a real business." A shell company says, "Nothing to see here, move along." Both are designed to deflect attention, but they deflect it in opposite directions.
The gray zone Daniel's pointing at is where things get genuinely murky. Take a shell company that suddenly needs to look real. Maybe a bank asks for proof of operations. So the owner builds a website, generates some invoices, hires a part-time bookkeeper. Suddenly, the shell is sprouting front-like characteristics. It's not a clean category anymore.
Or go the other direction. A front company's covert mission ends, the intelligence operation wraps up. But the business is still there, still functional, still has employees and contracts. Does it shut down, or does it just keep going as a normal company? At that point, it's no longer a front in any meaningful sense. It's just a business with an interesting origin story.
The taxonomy is functional, not fixed. What matters isn't what the entity was set up to be, it's what it's actually doing right now. Which is why the operational test is more useful than the label.
If the mechanics are so different, why do we keep lumping them together? The answer gets at a deeper question about how we judge financial structures. The term shell company has become a synonym for fraud in the public imagination, but the reality is that shell-like structures are everywhere in legitimate finance. Every time a company spins off a subsidiary to hold intellectual property, that's a shell. Every special purpose vehicle created for a merger, that's a shell. Every trust set up for estate planning, that's a shell. None of these are crimes.
The reputational damage is real, though. When the Panama Papers dropped 11.5 million documents, the headline wasn't Mossack Fonseca helped thousands of families with legal asset protection. The headline was, "Global Elite Hide Billions in Secret Offshore Accounts," and both things were true. That's the problem.
The Danske Bank scandal didn't help either. 200 billion euros in suspicious transactions flowing through a tiny Estonian branch, much of it routed through shell companies in places like the British Virgin Islands. When that story broke, shell company became shorthand for money laundering. But the structure wasn't the crime. The money laundering was the crime. The shell was just the pipe.
It's like blaming the suitcase for what's inside it.
And the suitcase gets used by everyone. Apple's Irish subsidiary structure, the famous double Irish arrangement, used shell companies to legally avoid tens of billions in taxes. Was it controversial? The EU ended up ordering Ireland to recover 13 billion euros. But it wasn't illegal. It was a tax avoidance strategy, not tax evasion. The distinction is jurisdictional and intentional, not structural.
Which is where people's eyes glaze over, and they decide all of this is just rich people cheating. And I get the instinct. But the line between avoidance and evasion actually matters. One is using the rules as written, the other is breaking them. A shell company in the Caymans can sit on either side of that line depending on what you're doing with it.
The Caymans example is instructive because the jurisdiction itself isn't the tell. The Cayman Islands have a sophisticated regulatory framework. They've signed on the International Information Sharing Agreements. Plenty of funds domiciled there are perfectly legitimate. The question isn't, where is it registered? It's, what is it actually doing?
The practical test we keep circling is the one Daniel's question implicitly asks for. When you see a company name in a news story, ask two questions. One, does it have real operations? Employees? Revenue? A physical footprint? 2. Who is the beneficial owner? If the answer to question 1 is yes, and question 2 is hidden, you might be looking at a front. If the answer to question one is no, and question two is hidden, you're probably looking at a shell.
Question two is the hard one, because beneficial ownership is where the opacity lives. London real estate is a classic case. Something like a third of properties in prime central London neighborhoods are owned through offshore shell companies. Some of those are Russian oligarchs dodging sanctions. Some are wealthy families who just want privacy for succession planning. The shell structure tells you nothing about which is which.
New York's the same story. Walk through Midtown and half the luxury condos are owned by LLCs registered in Delaware. Could be a corrupt foreign official parking stolen assets. Could be a tech founder who doesn't want their home address discoverable. The LLC doesn't know the difference.
This is the core insight I think Daniel's pushing toward. Shell companies are tools. They're not inherently good or bad. The moral judgment depends entirely on intent and use. A front company is the same way. BAC Consulting was a tool for an intelligence operation. The identical corporate structure could have been a legitimate electronics distributor. The structure is neutral. The purpose is everything.
Which means the question, are shell companies legitimate, has the same answer as, are cars legitimate? Yes, and also people use them to flee crime scenes. The tool doesn't determine the use.
The mainstream usage of the term has drifted so far toward the criminal connotation that we've lost the ability to talk about the legitimate version without sounding like we're making excuses. But every major tech company has a Delaware holding company. Every ETF you've ever invested in passes through a special purpose vehicle. These are shells. They're not scandals, they're infrastructure.
All of this leads to a practical question. When you see a company name in a news story, how do you figure out what it actually is? I think there's a simple first step most people skip. Apply the operational test. Does the entity have employees, revenue, a physical footprint? If the answers are no, you're looking at a shell, and the next question should always be, who's the beneficial owner?
That second question is where things get interesting, because it's not always answerable from your couch, but you can get surprisingly far. Open Corporates is a free database that aggregates company registries from over 100 jurisdictions. If you look up an entity and all you see is a Delaware registered agent address with no other presence, no officers listed, no filings beyond the bare minimum, that's not proof of wrongdoing. But it's a red flag worth noting.
Treat it like a heuristic, not a verdict. A company that exists only as a name on a form in Wilmington might be a perfectly legal holding company for someone's family business. It might also be the receiving end of a sanctions evasion scheme. The structure doesn't tell you which, but it does tell you to keep looking.
The flip side is just as important. If you've ever invested in an ETF, your money almost certainly passed through a special purpose vehicle. That's a shell company. If you work for a company that got acquired, the merger probably involved a shell entity created just for that transaction. These are everywhere in legitimate finance. The structure isn't the scandal. The hidden purpose is.
Daniel's question about whether the term has legitimate use. The answer is yes, and the legitimate uses outnumber the illegitimate ones by orders of magnitude. We just don't hear about the boring ones. Nobody writes investigative journalism about the special purpose vehicle that held mortgage-backed securities for 18 months and then dissolved quietly.
The legitimate shells are financial plumbing. You don't think about the pipes in your walls until one bursts, and when a shell company bursts into the news, it's almost always because someone used it to do something terrible. That's selection bias, not a representative sample.
Which is why the operational test paired with beneficial ownership is the mental framework worth carrying around. It won't solve every mystery, but it'll stop you from conflating a Mossad front company with a Delaware holding company. And it'll keep you from assuming every entity registered in the Caymans is a crime scene.
Where does all this go? The EU's been pushing beneficial ownership registers since the fifth anti-money laundering directive kicked in, and the US finally got its Corporate Transparency Act running. Companies now have to report who actually owns them to FinCEN. The question is whether that makes shell companies obsolete or just sends them shopping for new jurisdictions.
They'll shop. They always shop. The Caymans got pressured into transparency, so money moved to Mauritius. Mauritius tightened up, and suddenly Belize looks attractive. It's a game of jurisdictional whack-a-mole, and the moles are faster than the hammers.
There's a twist coming that I don't think regulators are ready for. The cost of building a convincing front company is about to collapse. Right now, BAC consulting cost millions because you needed real humans in a real office. But AI-generated companies, fake websites with AI-written content, synthetic employee profiles with generated headshots, fabricated invoice histories, that stuff is getting cheap fast.
The deepfake front. You don't need to rent an office in Budapest anymore. You need a language model, some image generation, and a few hours.
That blurs the line we just spent an entire episode drawing. A shell company with an AI-generated facade looks like a front to anyone doing surface-level due diligence. It has a website, LinkedIn profiles, a customer service chatbot. But there's nothing real behind it. The operational test breaks if you can't tell what's operational.
Which means the future isn't just shell companies hiding in new jurisdictions. It's shell companies wearing front company masks. The cost of deception is dropping, and the tools for detecting it aren't keeping up.
The question Daniel's prompt leaves us with isn't really about definitions anymore. It's about whether the categories themselves survive the next decade.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Black pepper's chemical heat comes from piperine, an alkaloid first isolated in 1809 by the Danish chemist Hans Christian Ørsted, the same Ørsted who discovered electromagnetism. The word pepper traces back through Old English pipor and Latin piper to the Sanskrit pipali, which originally referred to long pepper, not black pepper.
Ørsted had ranked, apparently.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to Daniel for the question, and thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you want to send us your own weird prompt, email the show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back next week. Until then, keep asking what's behind the paperwork.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.